Go 10 blocks west of where Fiss was shot, and you get to the Schuylkill Expressway. Follow it west as it curves past Central Philadelphia, past the Art Museum and the boathouses that light up at night. Hop onto West Girard Avenue, and then go west on Lancaster to Lebanon Avenue. If you'd made the 6-mile trip in 1992, you would have arrived at the Love Pharmacy at 6525 Lebanon Avenue. The Love Pharmacy was owned by Thomas Brannan. He was 64 and a very gentle and popular man. He often opened the pharmacy after regular hours, including all hours of the night, if people needed emergency medications. He had standing instructions to his employees. If they were ever robbed at gunpoint, no one was to offer resistance. Lives and safety were more important than money to Thomas Brannan. On a Thursday morning that November, 2 young black men ambled into the Love Pharmacy. Brannan's sister, Patricia Gibson, was working in the store. One of the young men told her he was suffering from stomach cramps. Gibson suggested he try the medication Donegal. The young man's friends suggested Pepto-Bismol. The men argued with each other as they took in the layout of the pharmacy. One of the men asked Gibson what time the pharmacy closed. She said 7 o'clock. The men left. Sharon Brogan went to the Love Pharmacy that evening to pick up a prescription. She entered the store around 6:30, but then remembered she had forgotten to bring a medical card. She lived nearby, so she turned around to go home and get it. As she exited the store, she noticed 4 young black men standing near a Cadillac in front of the store. When she returned to the store a few minutes later, the men were no longer outside the store. They were inside. One of them stood at the door. Brogan tried to get in, but the young man told her the store was closed. A voice in the background shouted, "Get her in here!" The young man grabbed Brogan and pulled her inside. A hold-up was underway. The man at the door went through her pockets and took her checkbook. Brogan saw the cashier, Maureen Quinn, in the back, while another woman, Diane Copes, lay face down on the floor. The leader of the robbers asked Brannan for a prescription drug. The pharmacist told him pharmacies in Pennsylvania did not carry that drug. Quinn, the cashier, perhaps remembering Brannan's instructions to be cooperative in the event of a hold-up, led the robber to a cabinet where all controlled substances were kept under lock and key. Misunderstanding what Quinn was doing and believing she was contradicting her boss, the robber asked Brannan why he had lied. The robbers made Quinn push the no-sale button on the cash register. All the store employees were now on the floor, lying face down as the robbers ransacked the pharmacy's money and drugs. They took a bottle of the narcotic, Percocet, 10 bottles of Xanax, about 60 money orders, and approximately $400 in cash. Then the women in the store heard a shot. It came from the robber standing over the prostrate body of Thomas Brannan. The pharmacist had been offering no resistance. He was shot in the back as he lay face down on the floor. Brogan heard one of the other robbers exclaim, "What did you do that for?" The robbers quickly exited. Quinn called police. Brannan was not dead, but he was dying. The pharmacist told medics his stomach was on fire. Gentle to the last, he made a quip when someone checked on him a moment later. "I've had better days." 5 days after Brannan's murder, someone tried to cash one of the stolen money orders from the Love Pharmacy. The cashier, Mitchell Wolfe, called Travelers Express, the bank that owned the account, and then the pharmacy, which was listed as the issuing agent. When Wolfe heard a recorded message on the answering machine that the pharmacy had been closed because of a murder, he called authorities. Police, meanwhile, were following up on a tip from a man who claimed to have heard something from one of the robbers. The tipster said the man who shot the pharmacist was called Arthur Hawthorne. The tipster identified Hawthorne in a photograph. Hawthorne was arrested 8 days after the murder. He threw a telephone at police officer James Westray when the cop burst through the door. Hawthorne tried to grab Westray's shotgun, The police officer reversed the gun and slammed it into Hawthorne's head and knocked him to the ground. The other robbers were quickly rounded up. One of the four, David Shepherd, said Hawthorne and another young man had asked the others to help pick up a prescription. He claimed he had not known a robbery was planned until it was underway. Shepherd said he had remonstrated with Hawthorne in the getaway car about shooting the pharmacist. It was fucked up because the guy gave up everything and there was no reason to shoot him. He was an old guy. Police showed a photo array that included Hawthorne to Sharon Brogan, the customer who had been pulled into the pharmacy as the robbery was getting underway. Brogan identified photo number 6 as the man who was standing over the pharmacist when he was shot. It was Hawthorne. The same day, Diane Copes, who had had to lie face down in the pharmacy, also identified Hawthorne as the man who had shot Thomas Brannan. Maureen Quinn, the cashier, also independently identified Hawthorne as the murderer. Number 6 looks like the man who grabbed Tom, and that's the man who shot Tom. Hawthorne's ex-girlfriend turned over a tape to police on which the robber had said he was going to have to leave her for a while and go away. And Hawthorne's sister said her brother had incriminated himself when she'd asked him if he was involved in the killing. "Shut up. You talk too much," he had said at first. "You must have had something to do with that. You're sitting there looking all stupid," she'd retorted. "Yeah," Hawthorne had admitted. "I killed that man." The crimes I've just told you about involve a number of other factors. At the time of his murder trial, Ernest Porter faced other robbery charges and a rape charge. Arthur Hawthorne had allegedly robbed two other stores in July 1992. When police officer Robert Dunn arrived at the scene of the second robbery, he found himself staring into a 9mm semi-automatic gun. At point-blank range, Hawthorne pulled the trigger. The gun clicked twice, but did not fire. In October, Hawthorne again pulled a gun on police. Both times, he was released on bail. Both men had had long and troubled emotional histories. Porter had been in psychiatric care since he was 4. Hawthorne came from a dysfunctional family where drugs ruled his life from an early age. In 2006, Stanford University psychologist Jennifer Eberhardt and three other researchers, Paul G. Davies, Valerie J. Purdy-Varnes, and Sherry Lynn Johnson, conducted an analysis of why some violent crimes produce death sentences, while others result in life imprisonment or lesser terms. Eberhardt and her colleagues examined a database of more than 600 cases in the Philadelphia area, cases in which the crime committed was serious enough to warrant the death penalty. From this group of cases, they extracted the photographs of all the black defendants who had been convicted of murdering white victims. The group included Ernest Porter and Arthur Hawthorne. They asked a large group of independent people who knew nothing about the cases, not even that they were looking at criminals, to rate the faces on one measure, the degree to which they looked stereotypically black. Whether or not race has any meaning as a biological construct, people had no trouble identifying stereotypically African features, thicker lips, broader noses, curlier hair, and darker skin tone. The ratings showed that Ernest Porter looked much more stereotypically African than did Arthur Hawthorne. Once the psychologists had obtained ratings for all the defendants, they compared the sentences of those who looked more African than the average with those who looked less African than average. Without any other information, without knowing anything about the crimes or the extenuating circumstances, without hearing arguments by prosecutors and defense teams, without having a chance to think about who made up the juries, you would think it would be impossible to guess which criminals got the death penalty. You would be wrong. Defendants who looked more stereotypically black than average were more than twice as likely to receive the death penalty as those who looked less black. If you split the convicts into two groups, The less black group stood a 24.4% chance of getting the death penalty. The blacker blacks had a 57.5% chance of being sentenced to death. Porter's conviction involved a far more circuitous case than Hawthorne's conviction. Porter was identified by the jeweler Vincent Gentile in connection with a robbery. Police then linked a gun thrown by a man fleeing the robbery to the Fiss murder. There were no eyewitnesses to the murder and no fingerprints on the gun. The only person who got a glimpse of Fiss's killer, the septuagenarian Catherine Valente, said on the day of the killing that she would not be able to identify him. In the other case, there were more than half a dozen people who saw Hawthorne kill Brannan, and several others who provided corroborating evidence. Raymond Fiss had had an altercation with his assailant before he was shot. By contrast, Brannan had offered no resistance and had been lying face down on the floor when Hawthorne shot him in the back. But it was Porter who got the death sentence and Hawthorne who got life in prison. It is important to note that Eberhardt's research does not tell us that Porter should have received a life sentence or that Hawthorne should have been sentenced to death. But what it does tell us is that there are systematic differences in the way people with Ernest Porter's skin tone and features have been evaluated in the Pennsylvania criminal justice system. Whatever our view of these cases in particular, and of the death penalty in general, we can agree that such results are disturbing. When the Pennsylvania Supreme Court refused Ernest Porter's appeal in 1990, Supreme Court Justice James T. McDermott told Porter that to escape the jaws of justice required extraordinary luck. Waxing eloquent from the bench, McDermott said, "Those who bring a criminal purpose to the daily lives of others, as did the appellant here, must pass through that sticky web of the ordinary round of things. To alter them to fit a criminal purpose requires more than malice and a gun. It requires that the passer-by, the late or early riser, the sleepless or ill neighbor, the returning party-goer, house painter, roofer, locksmith, cement crew, sudden fire, clocks running slow or fast, and the other quotidian needs and purposes that tie us to the earth synchronize with their single purpose. As the appellant was to find, they rarely do." McDermott was wrong. Chance, in the role of skin tone and facial features, plays a very large role in deciding the fate of men such as Ernest Porter. There are a host of other examples in the criminal justice system that reveal an appalling lack of consistency. Some kinds of crimes are much more likely to be solved than others. Some criminals get the book thrown at them, others get away with lighter charges. Prosecutors in urban areas are less likely than their counterparts in rural areas to seek the death penalty for cases involving crimes of equivalent seriousness. Where violent crime is common, there appears to be a desensitization effect that prompts urban prosecutors to unconsciously rate these crimes as less egregious than their rural counterparts do. A variety of reports suggest that police and the mass media are much more interested in crimes involving white victims than in crimes involving victims who are people of color. Also, Eberhardt found that the bias against darker-skinned convicts in death penalty sentencing was limited to cases involving white victims, and did not extend to cases where victim and perpetrator were of the same race. Something about black-on-white crime activated unconscious stereotypes that linked criminality with race in the minds of jurors. What explained the behavior of judges, juries, and lawyers in the murder trials that Eberhardt studied? Some judges and juries and lawyers could have been deliberately biased, but it is implausible that large numbers of them were overtly bigoted. It would have taken only a single juror, remember, to overturn a death penalty sentence. What are the odds that large numbers of juries that handed all the additional darker-skinned convicts the death penalty had comprised 12 people with unrelenting bigotry in their hearts? There is a better explanation for the data, a simpler explanation. Juries that decided to send all those extra people with Ernest Porter's skin tone to death were convinced they were doing the right thing. If you spoke to these juries, you would not find them packed with bigots. You would find upstanding people who were firmly convinced they were doing the right thing, much as Francis Abood's preschoolers thought they were doing the right thing in associating words such as cruel and bad with some faces rather than with others. Like in many other areas where the hidden brain influences us without our awareness, there is one fundamental problem that is rarely addressed when we think about racial disparities in the criminal justice system. Like deciding which people to hire for jobs or guessing which stocks to buy, the criminal justice system is based on the idea that human behavior is the product of conscious intention. We believe that juries that want to be fair are fair. We believe good intentions equal good outcomes. The assumption, the false assumption, is that biased outcomes result from deliberate bias and that such errors can be overcome by setting up a confrontational system where prosecutors and defense attorneys keep one another honest. Why do we hold so resolutely to this assumption in the face of all the evidence to the contrary? For one thing, it is easier. We are programmed to trust our memories, judgments, and perceptions. When we feel we are acting fairly, it is easy to conclude that we must in fact be acting fairly. Besides, the alternative is terrifying. If we accept the possibility that people, well-intentioned people, can be unconsciously biased into doing the wrong thing, even when they explicitly feel they are being careful and fair, we must acknowledge that our system of justice is not just prone to occasional error, but that it is designed to fail regularly. The jury system, after all, enshrines the personal intuitions of 12 human beings as the word of law. Given the unconscious errors that jurors, judges, and prosecutors, and even defense attorneys are vulnerable to, gross failures are inevitable, just as buildings based on a child's understanding of physics will inevitably fall. Reimagining our system of justice based on the new understanding of the brain and behavior is a daunting undertaking. It isn't surprising that we prefer to hold on to the myth that the good intentions of honest people can keep unconscious biases at bay when it comes to decisions involving the lives and deaths of other human beings. I began my reporting of this chapter with an assumption of my own. All the people that Stanford psychologist Jennifer Eberhardt studied were convicted of serious crimes. Her study focused only on sentencing disparities between convicts based on their skin tone and features. I assumed, going in, that Ernest Porter and Arthur Hawthorne were guilty. As I studied the murder of Raymond Fiss and the arrest and conviction of Ernest Porter, however, I discovered a series of troubling issues. The behavior of lawyers, witnesses, and police officers made me wonder whether Porter may have been a victim of unconscious racial bias, not only during the sentencing phase of his case, but from the very moment he was arrested. It turned out, first of all, that the police had interviewed two people who provided an alibi for Porter at the time of the Fiss murder. The police appear to have shared that information with Porter's defense lawyer because he mentioned these witnesses in his opening statement to the jury. Inexplicably, they failed to appear as witnesses. Both said later that they would have testified if asked. The witnesses were the parents of a young woman named Meredith Barber, whom Porter was dating. He was often over at her place. Meredith's mother, Harriet Barber, and her stepfather, Jesse Dawson Jr., were interrogated by police right after Porter was arrested. Both independently said that Porter had come over to their house the night before the Fiss murder and watched a Philadelphia 76ers basketball game. Both said Porter was still in the house the next morning, past the time when Fiss was murdered. The judge who presided over Porter's murder trial was Albert Sabo, who would come to be called the King of Death Row. In a quarter century on the bench, Sabo sentenced more people to die than any other judge in the country, according to Robert Dunham at the Philadelphia Federal Defender Office. By the time Szabo retired, his rulings single-handedly accounted for 40% of all Pennsylvania's death row inmates from Philadelphia, and Philly accounted for half the death row inmates in the state. A disproportionate number of Szabo's convictions involved defendants who were people of color. The fact that Szabo sentenced so many people to die does not automatically mean those sentences were flawed. What does raise serious questions, however, is that three-quarters of Szabo's death row convictions have run into trouble during the appeals process. Higher courts have found problems ranging from prosecutorial misconduct to improper jury instructions. A federal district court has ruled that Szabo's instructions to the jury in the sentencing phase of the Ernest Porter trial made it difficult for the jury to take mitigating factors into consideration. Prosecutors in the Porter trial struck off 8 potential jurors who were black. These potential jurors included longtime residents of Philadelphia. One was a former army veteran. Another man had seen a close friend killed and a cousin's wife raped, the kind of juror who is usually willing to impose harsh penalties. The black potential jurors expressed no reservations about the death penalty. By contrast, white jurors dismissed by the prosecution during jury selection were clearly conflicted about the death penalty. People like to say death penalty cases are the worst of the worst, said Michael Wiseman at the Philadelphia Federal Defender Office, which has represented Porter and other death row inmates who have seen verdicts brought into question by higher courts. They are usually the product of a prosecutorial judge, an incompetent lawyer, and an impaired defendant. Errors in the case surfaced the very moment police arrested Porter. He tried to tell them that his name was not Ernest Porter at all, but Theodore Wilson. When the issue came up during trial, the court stuck to the wrong name, in the interest of convenience. I have retained the name of Ernest Porter in this account because that is the name under which Wilson currently sits on death row. It is not his name, but it's the name under which the state of Pennsylvania plans to have him executed. Porter's lawyer did virtually nothing to challenge the circuitous nature of the prosecution's case, and the defense called no witnesses of its own. The gun that police discovered was not in Porter's possession at the time of his arrest, and was found several days after the Fiss murder. There were no fingerprints found on the weapon, even though police said it had been discarded by Porter as he'd fled the botched jewelry store robbery. More than one robber at Vincent Gentile's store had had a gun, but the defense did not explore the possibility that the Fiss murder weapon may have belonged to one of the other robbers. The officer who arrested Porter, moreover, did not see Porter throw a gun away. He saw him make a throwing gesture as he ran, and police later found a gun under a car in the area. Officer Kenneth Rossiter testified that he was certain the man he arrested was the man he had pursued in a lengthy chase, but the officer did not actually see Porter's face until he found him sitting on a step in an alley. Until that point, Rossiter saw only the back of a running man, and the running man was a block or more away. The police officer acknowledged that he had lost sight of his target several times during the chase, and that he was about half a block away when he saw the running man make a throwing gesture. Were you able to see positively what it was that this person discarded? The prosecutor asked Rossiter during Porter's trial. No, not positively, no, Rossiter replied. Rossiter did not see Porter leave Vincent Gentile's jewelry store. The police did not get access to the store for several minutes after the robbers fled because they had to be buzzed in. And it was only after Catherine Valente identified Porter on television, after telling police on the day of the murder that she would not be able to identify the killer, that the police linked the jewelry store robbery with the Fiss murder. Porter had been in trouble with the law before, and his fingerprints were on file, so it is not clear why police, who said they'd picked up a fingerprint from the beauty salon and were under intense pressure to crack the case, did not link Porter to the crime before Valente did. Neither Valente nor Angelina Spera, the witness who watched the beauty salon from the building across the street, saw Fiss's killer touch the exterior of the beauty salon's front glass door as he entered or exited. But this was where police said they found Porter's thumbprint. Vincent Gentile's testimony identifying Porter as one of the jewelry store robbers and Valente's identification of him as the man leaving the beauty salon were central to establishing the chain of links in the prosecution's argument. But right after Porter was arrested, the police showed Valente a photo array that included Porter and several other men, and asked her to try and identify the beautician's killer. She declined to look at the photos. In court, Valente said she was positive Porter was the man she'd seen leaving the Fiss beauty salon, but at no time did she ever pick Porter from a lineup or photo spread. The prosecution could have linked Porter to the murder even if Catherine Valente's testimony and the fingerprint were called into question. Vincent Gentile identified Porter. Officer Rossiter saw Porter throw something away that was later found to be a gun, and the weapon was linked by ballistics experts to the Fiss murder. But without a direct way to link Porter to the beauty salon, each of these links was essential to the prosecution's case. Much rested on the testimony of Vincent Gentile, who was a respected member of the community. But in 2006, with Porter still on death row and still maintaining his innocence, Gentile made an extraordinary admission. On April 30th, 1985, my Philadelphia jewelry store was robbed. Ernest Porter was subsequently arrested and charged with the robbery. When I later saw Mr. Porter at the preliminary hearing for the robbery, I did not recognize him. I told a woman who worked in the court that Mr. Porter was not the person who robbed my jewelry store. She said that defendants always look different once they are in court, and that the evidence showed that he was the one who robbed my store. Once I was told he was guilty of the robbery of my store, I did whatever the prosecution wanted, which included testifying about the gun at Mr. Porter's homicide trial, as well as at the robbery trial. However, in my heart, I knew that Mr. Porter was not one of the men who robbed my store. Eberhardt's study pointed a finger at juries who sentenced men such as Ernest Porter to death, but it seems clear that jurors were not exclusively to blame. I cannot help but wonder whether darker skin tone and features not only unconsciously predisposed juries to view some convicts harshly, but also unconsciously biased police, prosecutors, and even defense attorneys to weigh some lives more lightly than others. Ernest Porter has been on death row for nearly a quarter century. I interviewed him several times at the close security prison near Pittsburgh that houses most of Pennsylvania's death row inmates. Access to the area where prisoners talk to visitors was controlled by a series of five remote-controlled doors. Fences that seemed at least 30 feet high crisscrossed the prison. They were topped with loops of shiny barbed wire. Guards kept watch from turrets. Visitors were patted down, made to walk through metal detectors, and sniffed by dogs. I was separated from Porter by a solid glass window. We communicated using telephones. He was always in an orange jumpsuit and always had his wrists handcuffed in front of him. Porter had short curly hair and a moustache. Deep furrows lined his forehead. He did not seem particularly interested in Eberhardt's thesis that racism plays a role in death penalty sentencing. "There's nothing new about this," he told me on one occasion as I tried to explain what the psychologist had found. "Wake up. You live in America." Porter said the prosecution had initially offered his lawyer a deal, a guilty plea in exchange for life imprisonment. "I said, 'You have to be crazy,'" Porter told me, as he explained how he'd expected the trial to show he was innocent. A number of medical and psychiatric experts over the years have documented that Porter suffered from a range of mental problems, including delusions and mental retardation. Porter's defense lawyer presented no medical experts to testify about his mental health, even though the lawyer had access to extensive files detailing Porter's impairments and his horrific history of sexual and physical abuse as a child. Even if Porter were found guilty, the mitigating information may have headed off a death sentence. Porter seemed severely impaired to me. His moods were variable. A broad smile could be replaced by a hostile glare in the briefest flash. He was suspicious of everyone. He told me that he expected police to kill Vincent Gentile for retracting his testimony. He worried that his lawyers at the Federal Defender Office in Philadelphia did not have his best interests at heart. He believed prosecutors engaged in a conspiracy with police to have him framed. He spoke in jerks and stops. He left many sentences and many thoughts unfinished. He constantly repeated the phrase, "Here it is," as conversation filler. He told me it took him hours to understand what his legal papers said. Composing a simple note in response was an arduous challenge. Porter's account of events on the day of his arrest is light years from what prosecutors alleged. He told me that he had stepped out to catch a bus and had been caught up in an indiscriminate sweep of African-American men by police hunting down the jewelry store robbers. He said he knew nothing about any guns, jewelry store robberies, or dead beauticians. Porter believed the Philadelphia police framed him because an angry public had wanted someone in its crosshairs, and he was a perfect fit for every preconception of a dangerous criminal. You need only a few of these cases to run for public office if you are like Ed Rendell, Porter told me, referring to the city's then district attorney, who is now the Democratic governor of Pennsylvania. It is ironic, but the man who helped put Porter on death row might be the only person to stand at the 11th hour between Porter and a lethal injection. Porter's legal case is in a strange limbo. A federal district court upheld a plea filed by the Federal Defender Office that said Judge Sabo's jury instructions during the sentencing phase were flawed, and the federal district court ruled that Porter should not be executed. But the court simultaneously upheld Porter's guilty conviction after prosecutors argued that the case stood regardless of Sabo's poor instructions and Gentile's retraction. Porter's lawyers went to the Federal Appeals Court for the Third Circuit to argue that Porter ought to be exonerated. The state of Pennsylvania, meanwhile, appealed to the same court to argue that Porter was guilty and that he deserved to be executed. Porter remains on death row as of this writing, pending the outcomes of these cross appeals. Each day, he told me, he wakes early, exercises, and has a bird bath in his sink. After breakfast, he spends a couple of hours outdoors, locked in a cage with another death row inmate. The cage is about 8 feet high, 7 feet long, and 5 feet wide. He gets a basketball, but is told that it is a security violation if the ball slams against the cage. He spends the rest of the day and night in his cell. On weekends, Porter spends 24 hours a day in his cell. He gets to shower on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Porter told me his cell is 8 feet long and 6 feet high. It has a solid door and two small windows. The prison declined my request to visit Porter's unit. When Porter places his ear at a vent, he indistinctly hears the voice of the inmate in the next cell. He told me he talks at length to the walls and the floor. Porter reiterated his innocence repeatedly, but conceded his account was unlikely to be believed. If his version is true, it would imply a conspiracy involving several members of the Philadelphia Police Department, all the way from fingerprint experts to homicide detectives, with possible collusion from prosecutors. I've asked myself many times whether I believe Porter, and I must say I'm not convinced. But perhaps that is the wrong question. The real point is not whether I believe Porter's claims, but whether I believe the prosecution's claims. Is the case against Porter as airtight as we would like a case to be before we execute someone? I have a difficult time saying the answer to that question is yes. Porter painted a picture of city and police misconduct that seems unbelievable. except that 10 days after he was arrested in 1985, the same city and police department bombed their own town. With permission from the mayor, police dropped a bomb on the rooftop of a small radical group known as MOVE. The fire that resulted burnt down 61 houses and killed 11 members of the group, including 5 children. Over the span of 2 decades, the city of Philadelphia has spent upward of $40 million investigating the events that led to the bombing, paying settlements to victims, and rebuilding. The city block the police so recklessly raised was in predominantly black West Philadelphia. "My whole life is wasted for crimes I never even done," the man the state of Pennsylvania calls Ernest Porter told me. "You go to sleep with death on your mind, and you go through your day with death on your mind. It's enough to drive you crazy." Chapter 9. Disarming the Bomb: Politics, Race, and the Hidden Brain. In 1994, the psychologist Anthony Greenwald at the University of Washington was exploring links between unconscious mental associations and attitudes. I've talked about such associations before. Our hidden brain notices discrete things that regularly appear together and associates them. Every time we see one thing, it prompts us to expect the other too. We associate insects with stings and annoyance, rattlesnakes with bites and danger, and a garbage dump with disgust. There is nothing mysterious about this. Over the course of our lives, we have seen innumerable links between insects and stings, snakes and danger, and garbage and rot. Greenwald guessed that if he gave people a word, they would be faster matching concepts that were associated with that word than concepts that were not associated. It should be easier to bring America to mind when someone said baseball than when someone said badminton. Greenwald designed a word association game. He put the names of a number of flowers in a list with the names of various insects, and then threw in a number of positive and negative words, such as beauty, love, nasty, and ugly. Unsurprisingly, he found it very easy to group roses and tulips with beauty and love, and cockroach and beetle with nasty and ugly. When he put all the words in a single list and timed himself as he put a check mark next to all the flowers and the positive words, he completed the task a little faster than when he tried to check off all the flowers and the negative words. Every time his hidden brain heard rose or tulip, it automatically provided him with the positive associations that people usually have with flowers. When he encountered beauty and love, he checked them off quickly. When he encountered nasty and ugly, his conscious mind had to connect the unrelated concepts and resist the hidden brain's answers. Predictably, this took longer. So far, the test had not told Greenwald anything he didn't know. Who needs a test to find out he or she associates flowers with beauty? But Greenwald did not stop there. He replaced the names of the flowers and insects in his list with typically Caucasian names such as Adam and Chip, and typically African-American names such as Alonzo and Jamal, and then tossed in a bunch of pleasant and unpleasant words. He tried to play the same association game. Since he didn't consciously associate either Caucasian or African-American names with positive or negative concepts, he assumed he would associate all the names with pleasant and unpleasant words at the same speed. He was wrong. He found it was as difficult to associate white names with unpleasant words as it was to associate flowers with unpleasant words. But Greenwald's hidden brain effortlessly associated black names with words such as evil and poison. It was as if his hidden brain equated white names with positive concepts and black names with negative concepts. Greenwald was horrified. He didn't think of himself as a racist, and he didn't know what to make of his performance. He got in touch with a colleague, the psychologist Mahzarin Banaji. Without telling her what the test was about, he asked her to play the word association game on her computer. Banaji found she had results identical to Greenwald's. She effortlessly associated white names with positive concepts and black names with negative concepts. That's ridiculous, she thought. She knew she was no racist. She was a professor who spent lots of time teaching other people how to watch out for prejudice. Since Greenwald's test required Banaji to tap computer keys with her left or right index finger, Banaji figured the weird results had to do with whether someone was right-handed or left-handed, so she reorganized the test on her computer. All of a sudden, it was now her other hand that effortlessly grouped black names with negative words and white names with positive words. Banaji changed the order in which the names were presented. It made no difference. Her hidden brain simply found it easier to associate Alonzo and Jamal with evil and poison, and Adam and Chip with dream and heaven. Banaji sat back in her chair and stared. She felt small in a way she had never felt before. This is the origin of a psychological test for unconscious bias that has revolutionized the scientific study of prejudice in the last decade. Greenwald dubbed it the Implicit Association Test, or IAT. Millions of people have taken the free internet tests that he and Banaji have made available over the internet at www.implicit.harvard.edu. If you take what is known as the race bias test today, you'll see white and black faces instead of names, since this provides more accurate results. Hundreds of thousands of people have been disconcerted by their scores. Large majorities of Americans, including substantial numbers of African Americans, find it easier to associate white faces rather than black faces with positive concepts. Overwhelming majorities find it easier to associate men's names rather than women's names with careers and professional activity. The tests detect things that seem absurd. Many Americans are quicker to associate the British actors Hugh Grant and Elizabeth Hurley with being American than the tennis player Michael Chang and the television personality Connie Chung. It is as though their unconscious minds associate whites, even whites who are foreigners, as American, and Americans who are people of color as foreigners. In one set of tests before the 2008 presidential election, psychologists found that many voters unconsciously associated former British Prime Minister Tony Blair with being more American than Barack Obama. If you'd asked volunteers which one, Blair or Obama, was American, of course they would have looked at you funny. If people knew, at a conscious level, that Obama was American and Blair was foreign, why did their unconscious minds have the opposite associations? With every variation of the test, volunteers responded exactly as Greenwald and Banaji had to that first test, with disbelief. If the only thing the implicit association test did was to make people feel bad about the unpleasant associations in their heads, the test would not have been very useful. Ultimately, we're interested in people's behavior, not in thought crimes. But over the past decade, many experiments have shown that results on the implicit association test predict people's behavior in real-world settings. In tests conducted before the 2008 presidential election, for example, the speed at which people unconsciously associated Obama with being American predicted whether they supported the biracial candidate in both the Democratic primary and the general election. People who unconsciously saw Obama as less American than Hillary Clinton and John McCain were less likely to vote for him. This was so even if, when explicitly asked, they stated Obama was every bit as American as his competitors. It is useful to situate all conversations about race in their proper context. Voting against Obama did not automatically make anyone a racist, and race bias was just one factor in how people thought about politics. Race bias in the 2008 presidential election may have pulled the country a few percentage points in one direction. The bias would not have made a difference to the way most people voted, but it could have tipped people on the edge one way rather than the other. The bias affected both Republicans and Democrats. At an unconscious level, not seeing Obama as American exerted a subtle tug on people. It made them less likely to want to see him elected president. Remember, we are not talking about people who consciously thought of Obama as a foreigner with a doctored birth certificate. We're talking about people who never would have said aloud, or even to themselves, that they disliked Obama because he was foreign. But when they thought about the candidates, Obama may have just felt a little different. Hillary Clinton, John McCain, and Sarah Palin may have felt a little more like one of us. Once people felt that way, they could easily have come up with reasons to support their intuitions. You can always find things about a candidate to like or dislike. How do we know that unconscious attitudes about Obama preceded the conscious justification of those attitudes? In the experiment, it was people's unconscious attitudes, as revealed by Greenwald's test, rather than their conscious views about the issues, that better predicted whether they voted for Obama or preferred another candidate. The idea that we provide ourselves with explanations to justify our conclusions is counterintuitive, because it certainly feels as though our conclusions are the product of careful thought. Here is an analogy that might help. This is not an original idea of mine. Let's say you kick a soccer ball into the air. Imagine that as it flies, the ball suddenly acquires consciousness. How would it explain to itself why it is flying? It has no knowledge or awareness of having been kicked. But since it knows that all effects have causes, it tells itself that it is a ball that decided to fly, because that's the most plausible explanation. In the same way, once the hidden brain whispered to these voters that Obama was different, they quickly came up with plausible ways to explain to themselves why they didn't like the candidate, his views on healthcare, perhaps, or the economy. These results are upsetting and embarrassing. We know we are decades away from Selma and Birmingham, from those bad old days when women were not allowed to vote. We've changed, haven't we? Banaji once told me that the embarrassment she and others felt after doing the implicit association test was a good thing. It showed that people not only believed they were not biased, but that they did not want to be biased. Banaji, Greenwald, and another psychologist named Brian Nosek at the University of Virginia have studied the results of hundreds of thousands of volunteers who have taken the implicit association test on the Internet. The psychologists have created a map of America that shows the peaks and valleys of bias, the places where unconscious racial prejudice is highest and where it is lowest. Nosek has found, for example, that people in the 2nd Congressional District of New Jersey, which is nestled between the Delaware Bay and the Atlantic Ocean, have higher average levels of race bias than those in the 27th Congressional District in the Deep South of Texas, which includes the towns of Corpus Christi and Brownsville. Volunteers in Alabama's 1st Congressional District, centered around Mobile, show higher unconscious racial bias than those in the 9th Congressional District of California, which includes Oakland and Berkeley. Nosek overlaid his map of unconscious anti-black race bias on a map of electoral outcomes in all congressional races. He found a remarkable association between bias scores and political views. The higher the unconscious race bias scores in a congressional district, the more likely the district was to elect a Republican. The psychological research into the relationship between racial bias and political outcomes in the United States has focused mainly on bias against blacks. Ongoing research is exploring the effects of bias against other minorities. If racial bias had nothing to do with politics, and if the implicit association test was meaningless, as some of its critics have argued, there ought to be no correlation between bias scores and political orientation. But Nosek saw a very clear pattern. On average, districts with the greatest racial bias were more likely to vote for conservatives, and districts with the lowest racial bias tended to vote liberal. The difference, it should be emphasized, was a matter of degree. Large numbers of people in the Bay Area revealed the same anti-black or pro-white attitudes as people in Mobile, Alabama. But on a sliding scale, some areas showed greater levels of bias than others. This doesn't mean that you can look at a district's race bias scores and automatically predict whether the district will elect a Republican or a Democrat. As I said, bias is only one factor in people's political views, and it is far from being the most important factor. Some of the districts with the lowest bias scores, such as the 2nd Congressional District of Idaho, which includes the towns of Idaho Falls and Pocatello, are strongly Republican, while some districts with high bias scores, such as the 1st Congressional District of North Carolina, elected a Democrat in 2006 and 2008. There are places where race bias appears to be irrelevant to election outcomes, and places where it seems to play a substantial role. But of the 10 congressional districts with the highest bias scores among white voters, 8 were won by Republicans in the 2008 elections, and only 2 by Democrats. The 10 districts with the lowest bias scores revealed the opposite pattern. 7 were won by Democrats, and only 3 by Republicans. Race bias scores predicted not only whether liberals or conservatives got elected, but what kind of liberals and conservatives got elected. Fully half the districts with the lowest bias scores elected people of color. Only one district with the highest bias scores elected a person of color, and he was a Democrat. 5 of the 7 Democrats elected in the districts with the lowest bias scores were Asian, Hispanic, and African American. All the Republicans elected in the districts with the highest bias scores were white. In 2 of the districts with the highest bias scores, the 1st Congressional District of Alabama and the 9th Congressional District of North Carolina, control of the seat switched from one political party to the other in the middle of the civil rights movement. This was part of the dramatic shift in the American South away from the Democratic Party in the 1960s, owing to the Democratic Party's support of civil rights legislation that guaranteed voting rights and dismantled legalized segregation. The 1st Congressional District of Alabama elected Democrats from 1877 to 1963, 86 years, but elected a Republican in every subsequent election through 2008. The 9th Congressional District of North Carolina had elected a Democrat for 22 straight years before 1963. Starting in 1964, the district elected Republicans for more than 4 straight decades. Since we are talking about science, we ought to examine the research with a skeptical eye. Is the link between racial bias scores and political orientation merely a correlation, or is there a causative connection? If you see a lot of people holding umbrellas and wearing rain boots, it would be wrong to say that wearing rain boots causes people to hold umbrellas. The two things are related, but one does not cause the other. Both are caused by something else, the fact that it is raining. Could an unrelated third factor be responsible for both racial bias and political orientation? Second, isn't it possible that the connection between race and politics is better explained by simple demographics? People of color tend to vote for Democrats, so there ought to be a connection between diversity and whether a district elects a Republican or a Democrat. What does racial bias tell us that the racial makeup of a district does not? The question about correlation and causation cannot be answered with certainty. It is possible that the connection between race bias and political conservatism is only a correlation. The only way to prove causation is to conduct the kind of experiment that is impossible in real life. You change some people's unconscious racial attitudes and see if their political orientation fluctuates in response. If it does, you know that racial attitudes are influencing how people think about politics. Nosek believes the relationship flows in both directions. Race bias contributes to conservatism, and vice versa, and that both might also be influenced by other factors. People who are sensitive to threat, for example, tend to adopt conservative views and are also suspicious of people from other groups. The second question, the interaction between racial bias and racial makeup, has a clear answer. The demographic makeup of a district seems to act like a switch that sometimes brings racial bias into play and sometimes eliminates it from the equation. Anti-black race bias does not seem to play much of a role in districts that have very few black people. It is only when a district starts to show an element of diversity that unconscious race bias seems to influence voting decisions. In other words, everyday contact between whites and blacks appears necessary to make bias salient, to bring into play racial attitudes that lurk beneath the surface. Remember the study by Jennifer Eberhardt into sentencing disparities? The sentencing disparities showed up only in cases involving black-on-white crime, not in cases involving same-race crime. In the same way, the presence of blacks in a congressional district seems to make race bias relevant to the voting decisions of whites. But when there are a very large number of blacks in a district, the connection between race bias and political orientation among white voters is drowned out by the fact that blacks tend to vote for Democrats, and so districts that have a lot of blacks invariably end up electing Democrats. White voters in congressional districts where racial minorities make up more than, say, 40% of the electorate, certainly tend to vote Republican. The presence of minorities makes race relevant to the voting decisions of whites, but the tidal wave of people of color voting in the other direction renders that bias irrelevant. So, again, when there are few or no minorities, race bias doesn't seem to have much of an effect on political outcomes. The switch is turned off. And when there are lots of minorities, the effect of racial bias is again irrelevant because the tendency of whites to vote Republican in these areas is cancelled out by the tendency of blacks and other minorities to vote for Democrats. Race bias seems to tip congressional seats only in districts where you have both high bias scores among whites and a minority population that is sizable enough to be visible in everyday settings, but not so large as to control the congressional district's electoral destiny. Nosek estimated that race bias accounted for no more than 10% of the political variation in the country overall, hardly decisive, except in close races. Even this relatively small effect, however, produces clear patterns nationally between racial attitudes and voting outcomes. Many conservatives plaintively ask why psychologists don't spend more time analyzing the voting behavior of people of color. Nearly all African American voters, for example, voted for Barack Obama in the 2008 presidential election. People of color, in general, vote overwhelmingly for Democrats. Isn't this a bias too? It certainly is. I don't think it is an unconscious bias, however. Many people of color enthusiastically supported Obama because they wanted to elect the first non-white president. This is emphatically not the case with unconscious race bias and conservatism. White voters tell us that race has nothing to do with their political views. If most research focuses on the biases of white voters, it is also because these biases matter more. There are more white voters in the United States than voters who are people of any other race, and a bias that affects whites is likely to be consequential in a way that a bias among a minority group is not. History also tells us what to focus on. We have never had a female president, so it would be silly to spend time studying why some voters may be biased in favor of women, instead of asking why voters are biased in favor of men. Making connections between racial bias and politics always gets people upset. But if you look at this data calmly, you can say two things. One, the race bias data does not provide liberals with a cudgel with which to bash conservatives. Yes, it is true that on average, districts with higher bias scores tend to vote Republican, and districts with lower bias scores tend to vote for Democrats. But the fact is that race bias is surprisingly common across political orientations. A large majority of Americans, including substantial numbers of African Americans, hold negative associations with black faces and positive associations with white faces. But it is undeniably true that there is a steady association between higher racial bias scores and a conservative orientation on this and other psychological tests. We do not know whether race bias makes people politically conservative, whether conservatism tends to prompt people to adopt racially biased attitudes, or whether some third factor causes both. But if you are a patriotic Republican who passionately believes in the American ideal that all people are created equal, these results ought to be disconcerting. In the 1980s, the Democratic pollster Stan Greenberg identified a group of voters in Macomb County, Michigan. They were blue-collar workers, often union members, who had been staunch Democrats for decades. They voted their pocketbooks, and it was the Democratic Party that defended their economic interests. But starting in the mid-1960s, a substantial number of these voters switched parties. Greenberg found that in the 1980s, these voters supported Ronald Reagan, and Greenberg dubbed them Reagan Democrats, a term that has endured. Every 4 years, the national and international media descend on Macomb County ahead of presidential elections to see what the Reagan Democrats are up to. A few years ago, the plaintiff book, What's the Matter with Kansas, asked why so many blue-collar folks were voting Republican when their economic interests lay with the Democratic Party. Author Thomas Frank concluded, in large part, that these voters were influenced by hot-button cultural issues such as abortion, gay rights, and guns. Frank argued that the Reagan Democrats ought to vote their pocketbooks by supporting labor rights, progressive taxation, business regulation, health care reform, and other policies traditionally championed by the left. Republican politicians typically ask voters to vote their values, often defined by evangelical Christianity, ahead of class and pocketbook, particularly when it comes to issues such as abortion and the role of religion in public life. This is all perfectly acceptable grounds for disagreement. Liberals can disagree with someone who votes for president using abortion as a litmus test, and conservatives can disagree with voters who do not place religious values at the core of their political beliefs. But both sides have to acknowledge that these are all legitimate ways to determine one's political choices. However, many Democratic pollsters have argued that the Reagan Democrats' switch in political allegiance was not made on legitimate grounds. Rather, the switch was driven by an issue that we can all agree ought to be illegitimate in politics: racial bias. Let's start with what polls and electoral data tell us. If only white people could vote in U.S. presidential elections, the Republican candidate would always win. Democrats did not capture the majority of the white vote in a single presidential election between 1964 and 2008, including during back-to-back wins by Bill Clinton in the 1990s and Barack Obama's landslide victory in 2008. Successful Democratic presidential candidates managed to split the white vote, or get close, and then win a majority among people of color. White men in particular have overwhelmingly drifted away from the Democratic Party, and this trend, more than any other, has produced Republican victories in two-thirds of the presidential elections held between 1964 and 2008. If only white men were allowed to vote in elections in the United States today, it would be a complete waste of money to conduct an election at all. Pollsters will tell you that it is inconceivable for Democratic presidential candidates to win or even split the votes of white males. When successful Democratic candidates manage to split the overall white vote, it is usually because they reduce the magnitude of their loss among white men and gain an advantage among white women. For all of the talk of Barack Obama's post-racial win in the 2008 presidential race, he would have lost in a landslide if the election had been limited to white voters. Obama won only 43% of the white vote nationwide, and less than a third of white voters in the South. According to the National Election Pool exit poll, conducted by Edison Mitofsky, only 28% of Southern white men voted for Obama. Such numbers usually portend defeat for Democrats. Obama overcame his poor showing among white voters by racking up mammoth support among younger voters and people of color. But the fact that whites, and white men in particular, tend to vote Republican is not sufficient to conclude that racial bias is at work. If you were to talk to the blue-collar workers of Macomb County who moved away from the Democratic Party, most would emphatically tell you they were not motivated by racial animus. To many, even the suggestion would be offensive. And it is not as though Republican politicians make overt pleas to racial bias. Very often, race is never even mentioned in campaign materials, stump speeches, and party platforms. Most presidential elections, moreover, have featured two white males running against each other. So how do we know that the charge of race bias is not a fiction dreamed up by Democratic partisans who are unhappy that a group of voters have drifted away from their column? Let's look at the issues that many of these blue-collar voters themselves cite to explain why they drifted away from the Democratic Party over the last quarter century. These voters gravitated toward conservative candidates before gay marriage and abortion became hot issues. Concerns about crime, welfare, and affirmative action topped their list of concerns starting in the 1970s, and it is these issues, along with more recent concerns about drugs and illegal immigration, that have provided Republican candidates with their most potent electoral weapons. Affirmative action has an explicitly racial component to it, so let's leave it out of the discussion. But there is nothing inherently racial about welfare or crime, is there? You have white families on welfare and black families on welfare. Law-abiding whites and law-abiding blacks. White criminals and black criminals. Who can disagree that there ought to be less crime and fewer people dependent on public assistance? Conservatives have long provided a rational, if debatable, argument against welfare. They've argued that it provides perverse economic incentives for broken families and that it encourages laziness. If single mothers with children can get welfare while married mothers with children do not, does this not create an incentive for mothers to have their children raised in single-parent households? If you tie the size of a family's welfare check to the number of children a single mother is supporting, doesn't it create a perverse incentive for her to have many more children than she could raise successfully? And since welfare programs are directed primarily at the poor, doesn't the regular arrival of a check from the government discourage the poor from working? If welfare recipients were to go out and get even a moderately well-paying job, the check would stop. These are the familiar talking points of the anti-welfare argument. Here is how the Conservative Heritage Foundation puts it. Higher welfare payments do not assist children. They increase dependence and illegitimacy, which have a devastatingly negative effect on children's development. It is welfare dependence, rather than poverty, which has the most negative effect on children. Whatever your political views, and regardless of whether you agree with the Heritage Foundation's thesis, all sensible people ought to be concerned about the potentially perverse effects of an ostensibly high-minded program.